Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. You know, July 4th week, always a fairly slow news week in the retail world, but a couple of interesting stories came across our radar, actually three this week that we'll be talking about on the show. We'll also talk about firsthand retail experiences. Leighton, for one, went to Hawaii, so he's going to talk about some of his retail experiences there on the island. And of course, we'll be looking ahead to a couple of stories at the end of the show as well. Reminder to like us, rate us wherever you listen to us. Also check us out on Twitter, Instagram, at Retail Podcast for content on those two channels. One caveat, you know, I mentioned it's July 4th week. We're recording this actually the evening of July 3rd. There's a lot of fireworks going off in the background here. For those unfamiliar with Colorado, which is where I'm at right now, this is the first year in several that people have actually been able to fire off fireworks. So if you hear background noise for either Leighton or myself, probably those fireworks. And you know what? Fireworks in the news this week surrounding Walmart, because an article in Vox Media's Recode suggests Walmart may lose $1 billion this year in e-commerce between negative margins and system build-out. Now, this was probably the most prominent story this week in retail and broke at probably a bad time for Walmart, but a good one for Recode, because there wasn't a whole lot of other retail news out there. Several other news outlets like CNBC, Yahoo Finance published their own stories, citing this one as the main source. So let's get right down to it, which is the gist of the article written by Jason Del Rey.
That article that you're talking about, Trent, cites a number of anonymous internal sources stating that it is a likelihood that Walmart loses $1 billion on their e-commerce initiatives this year. Such a loss would, of course, erode organizational profits generated by brick-and-mortar segments. And if you look, additionally, the article outlines a number of ways in which Mark Lohr's desired initiatives have received pushback from leadership, including the desire to build out increased warehouse presence in the United States. This comes from a general premise that Walmart is attempting to compete on both depth and breadth fronts with Walmart's online store. Because Amazon really has a massive product selection, Walmart feels pressure to amp up their product selection at the same time. However, doing so means fulfillment of the more obscure items that you would need to come outside of Walmart's store network currently versus Target's model of largely fulfilling from inside their own stores via very hardcore logistics, if you will. The article goes on to describe the long tail concept as it pertains to retail. That leverage to expand margin lies mostly in the less popular, non-staple products. For example, Walmart and other retailers must compete on price on a staple good like bath tissue, but could charge more on a product with less turnover like left-handed scissors, for instance. So in order to have Amazon-sized tail, Walmart would need to vastly expand their system of warehouses, which are now mostly intended for brick-and-mortar fulfillment and not e-commerce fulfillment. However, the article cites a source that Walmart has agreed to expand their warehouse system somewhat. We didn't need a source to tell us this, as this very thing is happening to accommodate Walmart's new market-specific one-day shipping initiatives that we've seen throughout the country. Elsewhere, the article cites the other ways Walmart's e-commerce platform is costing the company money. These include employees focused on sourcing and brand connection, with Walmart's platform having added over 2,000 brands in the past year. Additionally, shipping costs aren't offset by membership fees like with Prime, so that is thought to be another way Walmart is struggling versus Amazon currently. And Amazon, for their part, has increasingly built out localized and independent, or in some cases, contracted delivery systems where Trent lives. He was telling me before recording this very podcast that Amazon products are frequently delivered by unmarked minivans or Amazon-specific vehicles rather than USPS or another delivery carrier. And myself, Trent, I see a ton of both marked and unmarked vans where I live. So just for those listeners out there, Southern California is inundated with Amazon packages, both large and small. Meanwhile, by the way, Walmart is fighting against the increased cost of shipping by adopting the local fulfillment center model, as cited in their next day delivery service. Granted, this would only work if customers stick to ordering the SKUs included in those warehouses and not those more obscure items that we mentioned earlier.
In all, this article takes a fairly bearish outlook on Walmart's e-commerce initiatives, going so far as to suggest their willingness to sell off one of their newly acquired brands, potentially multiples of their newly acquired e-commerce brands. ModCloth was specifically mentioned in the article as a candidate for sale, though Bonobos has also been in the rumor mill. And according to one of the sources in the article, all three businesses purchased by Walmart in the last couple of years, Bonobos, ModCloth, and Eloquy, are still losing money. Now, this should come as a surprise to no one, as even Jet.com was hemorrhaging cash prior to the Walmart purchase. But I think there are some takeaways there, some larger takeaways from the article. Now, again, this is something that was pretty much repeated almost sight unseen in a lot of retail news outlets. I think anytime that you can perhaps trumpet Amazon at the expense of a brick and mortar retailer generates clicks and certainly generates attention. And I don't want to take away from the work by Jason Del Rey in this circumstance. You know, it seems like he went to a lot of lengths to get some of the sources for this article and to write the article. But one of the things I kind of wanted to drive home here is to know the source of the article. And this is nothing against Jason Del Rey. He's a good journalist, solid journalist. He's been out there for a number of years. But at the same time, he primarily covers Amazon for Recode. In fact, if you look at the articles that he's written, probably 75 to 90% of them involve Amazon in some way. And I'm not saying he's Amazon's mouthpiece or anything like that, but a lot of what's in this article certainly does take an Amazon-centric bent. And if you look at it, it's almost kind of ignores the brick-and-mortar presence that Walmart has in comparison to Amazon. In fact, if you take the entire sales of Walmart as a chain, last year it was almost as much as the entirety of e-commerce sales in the U.S. taken as a whole. So again, we're talking about an issue of scale here. And so when you have things in the article like, and I quote this directly from the article, "Amazon is a very real existential threat to Walmart's entire future if the retailer does not significantly close this gap," talking about the gap between Walmart and Amazon and e-commerce sales. I think that's to fundamentally ignore Walmart's model that has worked so well for so long. And also, like I said, again, nothing against the author, Jason Del Rey, in this case. But you look at his past, you look at what he's familiar with. He's lived on the East Coast most of his life. He went to Columbia. He lives in New York now. And this is what I think the problem is with a lot of the retail media. Look, a lot of them live in LA. A lot of them live in New York. A lot of them live in Chicago. And it seems like there's a fundamental lack of understanding as to the way a lot of America shops. Because let's face it, Walmart's e-commerce presence, yeah, it's important. We talk about those double-digit sales increases in e-commerce every year. Is it profitable? No. We knew that pretty much from the beginning. Very few e-commerce businesses are profitable. It's just kind of a race to the unprofitable top. And Amazon has bankrolled their e-commerce presence for years and years and years through profitable areas like Amazon Web Services. But getting back to my point here, I think there's kind of a larger point that's ignored in most of the article, which is that it's almost as though brick and mortar isn't a viable option for Walmart anymore. And that just isn't the case. Again, they're bringing in record numbers in terms of brick and mortar sales. Same store sales continue to increase on the brick and mortar level. Traffic continues to increase. And this is because a lot of people don't either have access to more immediate Amazon services. Amazon's delivery is a little bit sketchy, maybe, where they live, or they go to Walmart out of convenience because they can't wait a day or two for what they're buying. And again, I think this comes back to the root of how people shop. And I guarantee you, if you go to a Walmart today, I don't care basically what time of day it is, I don't care where that Walmart's at, it is not going to look like a ghost town. And this article paints a very dreary picture for Walmart's future simply because their e-commerce sales isn't profitable. And I think that's kind of a misnomer there as far as Walmart is concerned because, again, yeah, those e-commerce sales aren't going to be profitable, but e-commerce sales for a lot of retailers, almost like a loss leader in the retail world. So it's more about drawing attention to you and getting that top of mind awareness. Now, with that, there in the article was a lot about potential drama behind the scenes at Walmart. So they were talking about the CEO of U.S. operations, for example, having it out or maybe calling into question some of Mark Lohr's contributions as CEO Greg Foran. And there was a lot going on in the article simply about internal tensions. And that was really played up by a number of other media outlets. Look, if you don't think there's internal tensions at most companies in general, but also retail front offices, I have some oceanfront property to sell you in South Dakota, because that's something that's going to be inherent in any workplace. And that's something, you know, we talk about disagreement is a healthy thing in the workplace. It's probably, to be quite honest, a good thing that Mark Lohr hasn't gotten everything from Walmart's leadership that he's asked for. At the same time, it's probably a good thing that Walmart's current leadership has a voice like Mark Lohr telling them what they need to be relevant in e-commerce. Because remember, Mark Lohr was the CEO of an unprofitable company to begin with. So it's not like Jet.com was setting the world on fire or anything like that. So again, there's going to be that give and take. And yeah, there are these reports that there's internal frustrations because Lohr is eroding the profitability of Walmart and that's hurting people's bonuses and so on and so forth. Look, you know, when you get to that level in an organization, it's not about hurt feelings necessarily, but it's a lot to do with ego. You know, you're in that position for a reason. Ostensibly, it's because you're good at your job. And so if you have someone come in and maybe erode your margins that you've worked so hard for on the brick and mortar front, yeah, that's going to be a little bit of a blow to your ego. But guess what? That happens everywhere in every corporate culture. And this article, and not so much this article, but a lot of regurgitations of the article act like this is the first time this has ever happened in the retail landscape and that there's trouble in Walmart and, you know, there's this massive toxic dynamic. I don't think that's the case. I think what you have here is perhaps healthy disagreement among the leadership. But again, you need that disagreement there, because if everyone just nods their head and goes along with things, you're never going to get pushback. You're never going to get refinement of ideas. And this is across the board, not just retail, but in any business, that disagreement's going to be healthy. So I get it. Maybe not everyone is on board with Mark Lohr. Maybe Mark Lohr isn't on board with all of Walmart's initiatives. But at the same time, that's almost a healthy relationship. You don't want just that bland agreement coming across the board there. Layton, what were your takeaways from the article? I know you read the article. Did you have anything different to add to that?
No, not really, Trent. You covered a lot of really important highlights. And I think that it is very common to see, to your point, a lot of executives, senior executives, looking at someone like Mark Lohr, who was an outsider, let's remember that, coming in, changing the dynamic, changing how they're entirely reinvesting into the company. Because remember, not that long ago, 9, 10, 11 years ago, the growth for this company was solely going to be sourced from international growth and acquisition overseas. And obviously they went into several markets. It did not pan out. Several markets in Asia didn't pan out. Germany, a famous case study, did not pan out. So if you look here domestically, one would have said 10 years ago, look, we're capped. Yes, we can grow at 3, 4, 5% a year, but in terms of those double-digit growth patterns, we're not going to get them here domestically. But Amazon has showed that they can dominate a space like e-commerce in terms of market share, of course, not in terms of overall retail sales, but in terms of the market share in e-commerce. And that is a massive opportunity for Walmart because of their distribution. And for Mark Lohr to try to leverage that current distribution network is extremely intelligent. I know that they really don't want to erode those margins that they have in the very profitable brick and mortar segment, or shall I say marginally profitable brick and mortar segment, but it is a company that needs to evolve to stay around 50, 60 years. It's interesting, Trent. I was listening to a recent Motley Fool podcast, and they have sort of an idea that they throw out there every so often when they're talking about several publicly traded companies. They say, if you're on a stranded island, if you had to pick between three or four said companies that are trading right now on the stock market, what would you pick? And I remember a couple of years ago, Walmart was thrown out there as a company they would not pick. And I think it's a very important point to make. Walmart is not trying to be in that position. They want to be the company on the island in 20, 30, 45 years even, in terms of still trying to capture the retail market share, trying to capture all of the customers that they've accrued over the last 30 plus years of doing business. They have a brand to uphold. They have that brand equity. And not only that, Trent, they really have a fiduciary duty to their shareholder to not be another Kmart, another Sears that sort of just cost cuts themselves into the ground. You need to expand. And if you need to expand at maybe a risk of eroding your margins in the short term and eliminating free cash flow for a few quarters, so be it. But Mark Lord, he's a visionary. He's extremely motivated to push the company forward. And if you're another Walmart executive that's been there maybe 25 years, looking at that is a little bit intimidating, but you really have to look at the bigger picture. What's best for the shareholder, what's best for the company, and what's best for their retail legacy.
We move on now to our next story, and moving on from Walmart, we actually go into a much smaller industry in terms of square footage, not necessarily in terms of sales, but certainly in terms of square footage. We go to the convenience store sector as a new quarterly report from the National Association of Convenience Stores shows that convenience store operators are very optimistic about summer sales. Now, this optimism is likely partially born out of successes in the first two quarters of the year. The survey includes a number of different convenience store operators in the U.S., independent and otherwise. And before you ask, no concerns about small sample size here with this study. 83 companies, 6,152 stores represented in this most recent survey. So, of course, there are a lot of convenience stores in the U.S., but this is a healthy swath of them. And this survey was released at the end of June. So it was kind of a survey that looked back a little bit at the first 6 months of the year and then looked forward to the third quarter of the year. We'll begin with some of the looking back parts of it. Of the retailers sampled, a whopping 75% say that merchandise sales, so that's sales excluding gasoline, were up versus the first two quarters of 2018. And this is interesting because we talk about kind of the opposite dynamic being true in the retail pharmacy sector, where those front of the store sales aren't up as much as companies would like or aren't up at all and haven't been up over the last 3 to 4 years. But with convenience stores, their merchandise sales seem to be going in a positive direction. Studies like these are important because so many of these companies are privately held or held by international firms. So we don't get too much of a look at same-store sales in the C-store industry. This study excluded from that, of course. So 75% say merchandise sales, or what we would call front-of-store sales in the retail pharmacy industry, were up. Only 5% during the first 6 months of 2018 saw a sales decline. Approximately 20% stated that sales were roughly the same. So this paints a very, very positive picture right now of the convenience store industry. And it's interesting because, especially considering the last article we just discussed about Walmart, basically alluding to this e-commerce being the way of the future and everyone's got to get out of the way of Amazon and this, that, and the other thing, and all of the continued regurgitation of that concept by other media outlets, you know, convenience stores have zero e-commerce presence, and yet their sales are booming currently. And of course, that's one thing Amazon hasn't figured out, is to deliver gas to your vehicle at your home. So people have to get gas at those convenience stores. But convenience stores are bringing in people for other reasons. It's not all about gas. And I think this is perhaps what I found most interesting. So there are a few reasons NACS attributed for this increase in merchandise sales. The first of which is the recent warm weather, and that helped out the May and June sales, although it doesn't necessarily speak to the positive sales that they saw in the other 4 months, but still recent warm weather driving more people out and about. Because of that, they not only need gas, but also if they're traveling or something like that, you have those stops along the way to make sure your family's taken care of. If you're traveling with others, they might want a drink or something along those lines. Now, the second real driver for this increase is the reasonable gas prices we've seen so far this year. Other than a brief spike in April and May, prices have remained in an area people seem to be accepting of. Now, speaking of that, fuel sales remained stable over the first 6 months of the year, according to these same operators. 70% reported fuel sales being the same or higher just in terms of dollar amount versus the first 6 months of last year. So the fact that you have stable fuel prices, they're a little bit down versus last year at the same time. That's driving more people out onto the roads. More people are seeing it being a reasonable proposition to travel via car, thus driving that traffic to the convenience stores. But as we mentioned, it's not all about the gasoline with these convenience stores. It's also about a value proposition, a convenience proposition, and also, as we'll talk about, a fresh proposition, which is why we wanted to get to some of the projections for the next quarter from the survey.
Well, Trent, I'm glad that you mentioned the convenience store sector for this latest story, because overall, this was one of my stories that I had from my latest trip to Hawaii. ABC Stores, a privately owned company there, is absolutely killing it. I'll get into those details in a little bit. But you can really see that this sector isn't talked about all that much. But it's interesting because if you look at these projections from the survey, this is really the reason we wanted to discuss the survey on the show today, is projections were almost uniformly positive. A whopping 83% of retailers surveyed were optimistic about their business for the third quarter in particular. This was a 12-point jump from the second quarter. Of course, optimism does tend to run high for convenience stores in the summertime, with generally more people traveling and you get a lot longer daylight hours in most states. And so you can look at the gas prices. They also may be to credit, but the gas prices were actually 20 cents less than on average a year ago at this time. So the lower gas prices should also be a benefit to all retailers, and we'll be really looking forward to this winter when retailers reveal how much the lower prices impacted distribution costs, or at the very least, offset increased personnel expenses for distribution. This optimism is fueled, pun intended, of course, by a few different things, but the retailers surveyed noted trends surrounding healthy food and beverage options as a main driver behind some of the potential sales boosts for their stores. The retailer cited three beverages in particular as being catalysts for potential sales: bottled water, lower calorie sports drinks, and they were both cited by 59% of retailers as having this strong potential. And this is intriguing because the constant push towards reduced bottled water consumption and increased use of reusable containers, of course, over the past few years. Yet, convenience store retailers still see the category as a major driver for growth for them, a major driver for sales, that is. As far as sports drinks are concerned, this fits in with what Coca-Cola and Pepsi, through their brands Powerade and Gatorade, of course, have been marketing. And both have released new flavors with their zero and reduced calorie lines. And Gatorade, in particular, has rolled out ad campaigns, as a lot of our listeners may be aware of, for their low-calorie options featuring Dwayne Wade and Gabrielle Union. Also, of note, sparkling water, which 50% cited as a potential driver of sales, you have to think that is an increasing category in terms of shelf space. I went into a convenience store the other day. It is just absolutely taking over. Flavored sparkling water is a new fad for sure. Especially when you think of sparkling water, we think of LaCroix. Actually, as an aside, we noticed that LaCroix CEO Nick Caporella wasn't quoted in their latest press release. Caporella, as we may recall, was quoted comparing his brand to a handicapped person and claiming underwhelming earnings were a result of injustice back in March.
So back to convenience stores. Based on the survey, they also seem to be bullish on healthier foods as well as healthier beverages. Now, 42% have added more packaged salads. 32%, according to the survey, have added more fresh fruit. And 25% have added more cut fruit or vegetables. Now, these categories are always risky plays for convenience stores. Not just convenience stores, but any grocer, because of the high rate of spoilage for these type of perishables, particularly salads, especially when you see greens-based salads there. To see that 42% of these convenience stores surveyed have added more of these products suggests that these retailers are moving enough to keep stock reasonably fresh, which again, as we mentioned, not all about gasoline at convenience stores there. If you know that you can go to the convenience store, get a decent salad, get in and out a lot more quickly than you could at a grocery store or a different restaurant, that's also a little bit of a play, especially for those who are busy enough to necessitate stopping at the convenience store in the first place. There's also been an increased trend surrounding health bars, with 40% adding to their stock of health bars so far this year. Now, we're seeing a big push not only around Lorabar and Kind bars, and of course, you're seeing massive ad campaigns around those two, but new brands like RX bars and also Perfect bars, which are in the refrigerated section as well, those brands are really starting to gain momentum. So you're seeing a lot of kind of meal on the go or energy during the day solutions here that are also offered by these convenience stores. Also, a number of them mention increasing the number of trail mixes that they have on hand. So another way of kind of conveying that energy type snack rather than just those candy bars, the chips that you're used to seeing in a convenience store setting. So again, focus much more on healthy goods, not for all convenience stores, certainly, but you're seeing a decent number kind of wrap their heads around it, start to change their merchandising in the convenience stores around these healthier foods, around the fresh options like salads, for example. Leighton and I have talked on the show in the past about Quick Trip, one of the largest C-store operators in the U.S., changing up their model to where they're much more of a restaurant almost than they are a convenience store, but a lot of fresh options, a lot of salads there as well. So just something to keep your eye on as you head into summer, as you head on your vacations yourself, just to check out those convenience stores and some different offerings, but certainly convenience store landscape looking a lot different than it did even 5 years ago in terms of merchandising and in terms of product mix.
I mentioned it last week, and I mentioned it 2 weeks prior to that, but I had a trip to Colombia, Medellin, Colombia, and to be honest with you, it was pretty much a trip of a lifetime. The reason being is I went to Colombia for stem cell treatment, and this sounds a little odd, but a lot of professional athletes go to Medellin, Colombia to get stem cell treatments. My knee and my ankle, Trent, I feel much older than I am in reality, and so I was pretty much desperate for a new treatment. There's a stem cell facility located in Medellin, Colombia called BioAccelerator. BioAccelerator is the global leader in stem cell therapy. They offer a state-of-the-art medical facility with the ability to treat patients with tens of millions of active adult stem cells to help them recover from injury or major medical complications that they may have had. BioAccelerator currently offers treatments for a variety of conditions ranging from orthopedic injury, spine and disc injury, chronic pain, and even severe autoimmune disease. BioAccelerator also has something for you men and women out there who are looking to stay in the game and keep yourself looking young and feeling youthful. I certainly need to feel more youthful as I get older. Ask about their anti-aging treatment and rejuvenation treatments as well. I will be tracking my progress as I go throughout the treatment process with BioAccelerator and going through the next few weeks here and really giving you, the audience, updates as I heal and overcome these injuries to see the true chain of events. Are these stem cells working? How I feel? And so on and so forth. Trent, it was a great experience. Medellin, Colombia, a beautiful place. We talked about their retail dynamic a couple of weeks ago. A great professional medical facility.
If you or someone you know suffers from a life of pain or complications due to a major medical condition, join the likes of UFC Hall of Famer Matt Hughes, Chael Sonnen, and Chuck Liddell, and many others like Leighton, and contact BioAccelerator. Start your path to wellness and become a BioX man or a BioX woman today at www.BioAccelerator.com/TheRetailFocusPodcast and tell them Leighton sent you. Again, that's BioAccelerator, spelled BioAccelerator.com/TheRetailFocusPodcast. Type all of that in and you'll be on the path to wellness today. Again, tell them Leighton sent you. We'll get to the rest of the news here in just a moment on the Retail Focus Podcast, but we're doubling back to a segment that we kind of started a few weeks ago with Leighton's trip to Colombia and continued last week, basically at audience request. We're continuing it this week. We're going to talk about kind of a first-person anecdotal retail experience that we've had over the last week since our last show. I'm actually going to go first because mine's a little bit more boring than Leighton's. As we talked about, Leighton went to Hawaii, so he's going to talk about that and his retail experiences there. I actually went to my version of a Kroger here where I live. their marketplace model. So for those that are unfamiliar, Kroger marketplaces sell just about anything, very similar to a Walmart Supercenter. They've got clothing, they've got a variety of health and beauty items and so forth. And the reason I wanted to bring this up, this is a store that I visit quite a bit, so I'm there pretty frequently, but they were having a 4th of July themed sidewalk sale towards the front of the store. Now, there wasn't actually anything out in the front of the store, but they were just kind of using the square footage in the front of the store that's usually reserved for seasonal items. But rather than having a lot of items surrounding the 4th of July, rather than pushing hot dog buns and the like, what you saw there was clothing, and a lot of deeply discounted clothing as well, a lot of summer clothing there. So I felt like that was an interesting move for this particular Kroger Marketplace location. You know, there were certainly other 4th of July displays, but again, the most prominent ones all had clothing and all had sale clothing. And you wonder if this is part of a larger effort in terms of Kroger's planograms to push clothing and to maybe ingrain themselves in the mind of their shoppers more as a clothing retailer. Pull a little bit more attention to that part of the store, because again, this is a huge shopping season for grocers. When you look at July 2nd through the 4th, a lot of people stocking up on those cookout materials, a lot of people going to those grocery stores. So the fact that they choose to prioritize clothing tells me first that they presume people are going to find the July 4th items anyway that they're after in the store, so no reason to push them towards the front of the store to begin with. And second, they're really trying to prioritize clothing, particularly seasonal or summer clothing at this point in time. So it'll be a kind of an interesting thing to keep an eye on as far as Kroger is concerned, just to see if this is something they choose to do for future seasonal occasions. Maybe once you get towards the winter, if they start pushing sweaters, that type of thing, towards the front of the store. Just something I'm going to be keeping an eye on there. But I thought that in particular was very interesting how they had the store merchandised.
Well, Trent, that was boring, as you may have hinted at. But my trip was very exciting. I actually just came back from Hawaii 2 days ago now. And I was in Oahu, which of course holds the capital of Honolulu. It was an interesting trip. I was there for around 5.5 days, and I visited a number of sites throughout the island, and it was a very, very good experience. I would say, though, I'd rather go to Colombia, if I'm being honest. Hawaii is a beautiful place. It's more beautiful than where I live currently, but just something about it didn't scream out to me as a place that I would want to live for an extended period of time. Still, a beautiful island, a lot of commerce going on. Speaking of that commerce, I made a bunch of notes because I knew that this segment was probably going to happen yet again this week, where we were talking about a retail experience that we've had firsthand. And I made a few notes here, Trent, so I'm going to be looking at my phone as I read some of this off, but my retail notes are pretty comprehensive. So I was looking at the local things that were going on and also the larger scale things that go on in the rest of the United States. And so if you look, there's a lot of GNCs. I noted this a lot throughout the island. There's a regional shopping center. It seems like every single block, regional shopping centers really take the place of those larger indoor malls for their society, I guess, if you will. GNCs are pretty much everywhere. It's interesting that that supplement market really is hitting an all-time high. I feel like everybody is trying to peddle something there, but GNC extremely popular there. I drove by a Kmart. I drove by the original Kmart there, the first Kmart to actually land on the island, on the state of Hawaii, 1992. It was actually sold off in 2016 by Seritage Growth Properties. Seritage Growth Properties, obviously a REIT that was spun off from the Sears Corporation several years ago by Eddie Lampert, of course. Seritage Growth Properties had something in their lease agreements with Kmart and Sears. When they took over those stores, when they took over the ownership of those properties, they were given the right to actually dispose of or actually get out of the leases prematurely. And this is pretty much unheard of because you're basically not even in a lease if either party can just leave with no notice. And that's pretty much what happened. A lot of people were saying that that Kmart in particular was underperforming. A lot of other people were saying, no, it was a real estate move on behalf of Seritage Growth Properties because Those shareholders saw a larger development in the future for that particular area. That original Kmart, Trent, again, built in 1992, a massive Kmart. It rivaled the one I visited in Long Beach over a week and a half ago. It was just a massive store. As such, it's now been redeveloped to be a Ross Dress for Less and two other larger retailers. So if you look at the property, it's actually a fairly substantial property in terms of the traffic flow, in terms of the number of customers that are interested in what's in there now. Of course, Ross hitting all-time highs on the stock market over the past couple of years. So if you look at those retailers, they're doing far better than Kmart would have done. If you look at the county records, Trent, a year ago, that property is now valued at $19 million. I don't think there's a lot of Kmarts right now that are valued at $19 million per their lease agreement. So they certainly, in my opinion, did the right thing to try to redevelop that property. However, the nostalgic person in me, the nostalgic retail lover, is really sad that that was one of the last Kmarts on the island. In fact, the last Kmart on the island shut down in September of 2018. So not that long ago. It's one of the saddest moments for me is to read about these stores having closed. If you do a little bit of research, not to harp on Kmart, but there was a total of 7 stores at one time in Hawaii, 4 on Oahu, and then 3 on 3 other islands. So they did, in fact, have a very large-scale presence. If you look back in some of the notes, senior management at Kmart had been wanting to get on the island since 1982, and they put in a massive plan in place, and they really saw an opportunity because there's not a lot of general merchandise retail on the island, which brings me to my next point. General merchandise retailers, there are plenty of them now. There are a couple Walmarts, but I'll tell you what, Trent, the number one retailer, and I texted you while I was on my trip about halfway through my trip, I said Target is a dominating force in Hawaii. And I say that not lightly. It is a massive retailer. They have redeveloped several locations. They're in areas that you would not imagine a Target doing business in. Areas with small population density, areas that are hard to get to. It does not matter. Target is extremely popular. They keep up their stores very well. All of the stores said they're hiring. And one store in particular really stood out. It was a redevelopment project from one of the major malls there, a mall that we're going to post pictures of on Instagram. This was a redesign, a two-story mall, two-story outlet, I should say, for Target to inhabit. They have done an amazing job with their product selection, localizing their merchandise, meaning that they have everything for the tourist, for the people that live there, a massive grocery section, a very large alcohol selection, which brings me to my last point about Hawaii. They have what's called ABC stores. And I was curious because I remember thinking back, where have I seen ABC stores previously? It turned out to be Las Vegas. However, ABC store actually started in Waikiki in 1964. So you're going back many, many decades, but you're talking about a business that is still really primarily run by the first family, the family that initiated the business in 1964. And if you look now, Kosasa is his name, who owns the store. He's 56 years old. He owns now all of the stores, 78 stores in Hawaii, Las Vegas, Guam, and Saipan. Over 1,000 employees. And I'll tell you what, Trent, what really struck me as interesting was this wasn't just your typical convenience store, sort of maybe the stores that were in our survey that we were discussing earlier from those results. This is a store that is really predicated upon the tourist, the active tourist seeking fun. So they had a lot of clothing, they had Lay's, but more than anything, they had alcohol and tobacco products. And I thought this was interesting because this was far more than what you would see at your local 7-Eleven or Trent mentioned Quick Trip earlier. They absolutely dominate the alcohol space and they have it pretty much front and center for their customers. Furthermore, they have so many of these locations. I spotted 6 within a half square mile. I'll repeat myself, 6 stores within a half square mile. And that was just me walking. This wasn't me actually going on MapQuest and finding these stores. So they could have had actually a larger density of ABC stores in Hawaii or where I was at in Honolulu. It is just astounding to me. There's not a lot of other convenience stores without gasoline like there are with ABC store. And so that is a huge takeaway from the retail perspective. Lastly, Trent, the one thing I'll end on, and this is going to be a throwback to our food focus podcast where we would talk about quick service restaurants and full service restaurants. McDonald's also dominates that island. So we talk about Target dominating. Well, guess what? In terms of fast food, McDonald's is pretty much everywhere, but it's not in the same footprint. The McDonald's looks different than it does here in the United States. In the United States, we can all tell what a McDonald's is going to look like. However, there, they must have some sort of stipulation in place that if you're going to develop a new McDonald's, it has to be a different look, because every single McDonald's that I saw looked extremely, none of them looked like an ordinary McDonald's. Some were two stories, some had a brick facade, some were colored differently, some didn't even have the golden arches. They just had small letters that said McDonald's and a beautiful glass front. You're like, am I in a parallel universe with McDonald's now? So just a few oddities for Hawaii, but all in all, I believe that it is specific to that island, and I think that's exactly what makes it unique, not only from a tourist perspective, from a retailing perspective, but Hawaii in it of itself is a unique habitat, and I believe that retail has really embodied that through the test of time. And to be honest with you, Trent, I would go back to Hawaii, but I'm looking forward to my next Colombian trip. If I had to choose over the past 3 weeks between those two trips, Colombia wins.
That's amazing, and I appreciate you taking all of those notes there. A lot of excitement in the retail landscape to an extent in Hawaii. As you mentioned, the ABC stores big there, Target big there. One other store that's large there that you didn't mention is Costco. Costco has a pretty big presence there in Hawaii. Well, we want to move on to our last news story of this podcast, as Chico's says no thanks to another buyout attempt by Sycamore Partners. Now, this is a truly odd situation. Sycamore Partners' most recent bid for Chico's is even less than their prior bid that they put in. Their bid of $3.50 per share in May was rejected unanimously by Chico's board of directors. This was slightly below Chico's share price at the time. So what do you do when your prior bid was rejected? Most private equity firms would increase their bid or sweeten the pot. Not Sycamore Partners. Sycamore decreased their bid to $3 per share. For reference, Chico's share price was around $3.30 per share at recording today. Sycamore's bid, therefore, about 10% less than the current share price. As such, the board rejected it in an open letter posted to their investor relations page this week. So what are some potential reasons behind this extreme lowball bid for Sycamore? Well, the most obvious explanation seems to be that Sycamore hopes Chico's board will assume that Chico's stock price has a chance of decreasing by that much, and they should perhaps cut their losses while they can. So this is perhaps the prevailing logic here. However, when you dig deeper, this doesn't quite add up, especially with Sycamore announcing back in May that they have taken a 6.6% stake in Chico's. So our friends at Motley Fool suggest that Sycamore might just be making noise around the company to attract attention for a higher takeover bid by someone else. In so doing, they would be able to cash in on their 6.6% stake at a hopefully, for them at least, hopefully higher level than where they bought in. Another potential is that Sycamore could be hedging, so either the takeover bid is accepted if the share price continues to fall, or the company turns it around and Sycamore cashes in on that 6.6% stake. Either way, though, Chico's as a company does look as though it's in serious trouble. This is something that we've talked about. We haven't talked about them in about the last year on the podcast, but the last time we talked about them, we talked about their same-store sales going down. You're seeing same-store sales on average mid-single-digit declines year over year. Their operating cash flow, though, has plummeted from $61.9 million in the 2018 first quarter to just $5.7 million in the most recent quarter for 2019, which would be the 2019 first quarter. So what this suggests, at least to me, just kind of looking at it from the outsider, is that the company's dividend, which currently sits at a little over 8 cents per share for the most recent quarter, might be in danger. So anytime you see operating cash flow declining, companies start to tighten up or cut off their dividend entirely, something we just saw with GameStop. And indeed, the dividend might be the only thing keeping the share price where it's currently at, because faltering earnings, same-store sales down as much as what they are, you would think the share price would be a little bit lower, just like it has been for other retailers in the fashion space. You think about Stage being one of those that's certainly down significantly. You think about the likes of Kato also being down significantly, and all of these retailers that we talk about, Ascena being another one, having same-store sales down in the mid-single digits. And while the company has a turnaround plan in place, including increased investment in e-commerce, you'd have to think that they need capital for those investments. That money's not just going to come from nowhere. As such, they might choose to elect that GameStop route of ceasing their dividend. If this happened, we would expect a mass exodus of institutional investors, of which Chico's has plenty. BlackRock and Vanguard, for example, are their two largest investors as a whole, according to the most recent filing. And we saw the effect that this had on GameStop share price, which is a significantly negative effect, where the share price went down double digits. So, Leighton, that leads to potentially a third possibility here.
Yeah, that third possibility being that Sycamore Partners is maybe feeling out the Chico's board of directors for clues about the future of the company, and the board might be a little more willing to accept a lowball offer if they thought that the share price would crater because of an upcoming dividend announcement in the next year or so. Granted, they would still have to convince shareholders that the idea is a good one, and this might be a little bit of a difficult pill to swallow. Even in the unlikely circumstance Sycamore does buy Chico's at some point in the future, their success with retailers has been less than stellar, let's be honest. And we're reminded of the weirdness with Dollar Express, and they also hold companies like Belk, Staples, and The Limited. And although we can't see these companies' results any longer because they are private, it is clear that they're not setting the world on fire at the moment.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I look ahead at a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. I'll actually go first in this episode. My looking ahead story has to do with retail pharmacy, a segment that I mentioned earlier on in the show. More specifically, I'm looking at Rite Aid. So to look ahead, I'm actually going to look back last week after we had recorded our podcast, but it was long enough ago where we didn't want to include it in this one. Rite Aid actually released earnings for their most recent quarter. Now, the earnings themselves weren't necessarily stellar, but their stock did pop pretty significantly, and full disclosure, I was, up until recently, a Rite Aid shareholder there. But part of the reason their stock popped so much is because they had an increase in script count unlike any increase they've seen over the last couple of years. So this is the first quarter for fiscal year 2020. They saw a 3.7% increase in script count and a 2.3% increase in prescription sales. So the number of prescriptions went up, sales for prescriptions went up, and you know what? That front of store sales, which had been pretty bad for Rite Aid in the past, down just 0.3%. And they put a lot of initiatives in place to try and boost their front of store sales, including kind of retooling some of their service mechanisms to try and bring service back to the Rite Aid store to where it feels more like a curated retail experience. So the reason I'm looking ahead first is this increase in script count just a blip, just a flash in the pan, or is it something more substantial? They've now had four consecutive quarters with an increase in same-store script count. Second, is their same-store sales headed in the right direction? So is that 0.3% decline more than a blip as well? Can they turn that into something positive? Now, in the second quarter, I should mention, they're going against pretty good front of store sales comps, but again, just overhauled their front of store sales. They're working to include some of their tie-ins with Amazon in some of their stores. So can this drive Rite Aid to eventual profitability? Now, they were far from profitable in the most recent quarter, but again, now that they know kind of what they're dealing with, now that they know exactly who they're dancing with in terms of the number of stores in their portfolio and so forth, they can start to overcome all of the merger talks, a lot of which fell through, and really focus on their store base. Can Rite Aid return to being a rightful competitor to CVS and Walgreens? So a lot to look for here in Rite Aid, especially over the next, I'd say 4 quarters or so, as management starts to implement this new plan for the new refreshed Rite Aid.
I will keep my looking ahead story a little bit quick with Nike. Nike was in the news for all sorts of reasons this week, but I'm going to focus on a story last week with their earnings report coming due. If you look through the earnings trend, it was actually a very solid report. I say actually, not that we assumed it would be anything other than decent, but Nike had reported above average revenue due to, and this is why it's my looking ahead story, increased direct-to-consumer investment. So this is directly tied to their initiatives over the past 2 to 3 years. A lot of people have talked about Nike maybe overspending for some of their initiatives, akin to maybe Under Armour spending too much on wearables and technology investments that had to be written off over the subsequent quarters after they made those acquisitions. Under Armour doing far, far worse than pretty much anybody in the space. A lot of people had high hopes, myself included, by the way, for Under Armour. I was a shareholder at one period of time. But Nike is just doing so well year after year after year. That brand is going to stick around for the long term. I myself thought maybe a few years ago, you know what, something could happen to Nike to where it does not carry the same sort of brand equity that it once did. But Nike is seemingly doing no harm in every single move that they're making with technology, with everything. But my looking ahead has to do with the overall market share with e-commerce sales. And I don't want to make that too much of a theme for this podcast, but if you look at the overall revenues that they're bringing in, just over $10 billion for the fiscal fourth quarter. That's not only a 4% increase year over year. Yeah, that's nice and that's modest. But a larger percentage of that $10 billion is coming from the direct-to-consumer landscape, how they're advertising with their app, how they're converting customers with their app, meaning they're getting people through advertising, organic ads, and things of that nature to download their app. And then from there, customers are buying shoes from the app that they hadn't even tried on, meaning the Foot Lockers of the world, the Dick's Sporting Goods of the world, the niche retailers of the world that, by the way, are pretty much everywhere in Southern California that are really presenting all of the type of Nike shoes that they have on their platform. Are those retailers going to be hurt? Those traditional brick and mortar retailers that really want to sell you the experience of being able to see, touch, and feel those shoes before you actually buy them on a app or on an e-commerce website once you get home on your desktop computer. So my looking ahead story is, can Nike keep this up as much as their stock price has been up over the past 5 years? Or is it sort of just a blip on the radar and people are always going to be in the market for a service-oriented shoe experience? Because we talk about this all of the time with the grocery sector. We talk about this with produce. People want to touch and feel their produce before they bring it home. They want to make sure that they have the right type of ripeness with their bananas, their pears, their apples. Is this going to be the same thing for shoes? Are they going to be able to unlock a type of experience that really is like what you would get if you go inside an indoor mall and walk in to a Foot Locker and get that one-on-one service with their sales associates? I just think that there is a market for both. However, looking at those sales figures, again, $10 billion in revenue, more of it historically than ever has come from e-commerce and their digital landscape. Very curious to see how that plays out and if they're really hurting their own partners, because if you look at all of their logistics, they're still sourcing a majority of their product to retailers. We're talking about brick and mortar retailers here that aren't just under the Nike banner. These are the Foot Lockers of the world. These are the famous footwears of the world that are selling Nike shoes. Are they putting their own partners out of business because they've been doing so well innovating in e-commerce?
Well, that'll do it for us here on this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Once again, for Layton, I'm Trent saying so long until next week. Check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. We'll be back approximately 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.